Blog Talk Radio. Greetings, this is Abayomi Azikiwe, and welcome back to another edition of the Pan-African Journal. The Pan-African Journal is an audio news magazine that's brought to you here on a weekly basis. I am your host, Abayomi Azikiwe. Today is Sunday, April the 9th, 2023, and we're broadcasting live from our studios in downtown Detroit. Well, I thank all of our listeners for tuning in once again to yet another edition of the Pan-African Journal, this special edition of our program. Later on, we'll be bringing you our regular Pan-African Newswire segment. We'll have dispatches on the recently released augmented report from the Central Committee of the South African Communist Party. More migrants have been found dead off the coast of the North African state of Tunisia. Drilling for oil in the Kalahari in southern Africa may impact the vast wildlife habitat. And the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, the DPRK, has tested a new underground missile system. In the second hour, we look at the declining influence of the United States dollar as the world moved towards a multi-currency system. We then look back on the 30th anniversary of the martyrdom of South African Communist Party Secretary General Chris Hani. Finally, we continue our tribute to the 125th birthday of Paul Robeson. These and other features will be brought to you during the course of our program, so stay tuned. We will take our musical interlude with the Bozi Boziana and Anti-Shock Orchestra from the release entitled Mitsuri. Let's listen in.
Yeah. maison business yes elinkoy oh ne organisation solo là na bosse ni na London.
Salome, tia, masina, mamila, dulu. kosalela soki nalingaka te mele nakokaki kopesa te oyo osengaka ngai
ikemela
ata banyongo oyo otefaka na moziki na bino kaka nga moto nakutelaka yo mpo na koebite barankine ochange kaka te o akosaka ngai okei kokongola mbongo ya banyongwe
yango ebebisaka ngai motema akoma esur na yo bajisukana yango ebebisaka ngai motema akoma esur na yo bajisukana
Mela, 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 mela
Yo venga, yo cojo a mi familia, na kunga debi na makambo mosusu oye na lingela e na makambo mingyo kasi makambo mango makoma ya kala moke oyo ngana zui na la vie nini lisusu na koluka na mokili bakota bonganga bazwa maboma bakoluka kaka po bazwa depi ya mende l'avenir ezali mama yeye ninyangonga na wela.
Oh,
Welcome back. And that was the music of Bozy Boziana and the Anti-Shock with the album Mitsuri. And you're listening to the Pan-African Journal, a worldwide radio broadcast. And right now we're going to go into our Pan-African Newswire segment of the Pan-African Journal. And our lead story deals with a augmented report that was recently issued by the South African Communist Party. The South African Communist Party held its annual augmented central committee meeting over the weekend of March 31st to April 2nd in Bloemfontein, Johannesburg. The meeting included expanded representation from the South African Communist Party provinces and districts, as well as from the Young Communist League of South Africa. The Augmented Central Committee was convened to finalize the outstanding task of the Central Committee given by the resolution from the SACP 15th National Congress on State and Popular Power and Electoral Considerations. The meeting was preceded by intensive and robust discussions by the provincial and district structures of the South African Communist Party over the last 2 weeks. Assessment of the developments in the country and the world was presented by the General Secretary, Comrade Sally Mapela, followed by a Central Committee discussion paper titled State, Popular, and Electoral Considerations, Contesting Elections More Effectively with or Without a Reconfigured Alliance. And you can read this article in its entirety over the Pan-African Newswire website. In other news taking place in North Africa, in the state of Tunisia, at least 24 migrants trying to make their way to Europe died over 2 days when their fragile, overloaded boat sank. The prosecutor's office of the coastal port city of Sfax said yesterday. The Tunisian Coast Guard pulled the bodies of four African migrants from the waters off the coast of Sfax yesterday, while 36 migrants were saved and three others were missing, according to Fouzi Masmoudi, a spokesman for the prosecutor's office in Sfax. A day earlier, 20 African migrants drowned when their boat went under about 35 miles, about 56 kilometers from Sfax, and 17 others, including three children, were saved, Masmoudi said. He added that two of the survivors pulled from the water were reported in critical condition. The numbers of migrants launching from Tunisian coastal waters and aiming to reach the shores of Italy have skyrocketed during this year. The Coast Guard intercepted numerous other boats loaded with migrants on Friday as well as Saturday, Masmoudi said. And you're listening to the Pan-African Newswire segment of the Pan-African Journal. I am your host, Abayomi Azikiwe. And, of course, in the Kalahari region, particularly in Botswana, the water and wildlife-rich land is fed by rivers in the Angolan highlands that flow into northern Botswana before draining into Namibia's Kalahari Desert sands. Several indigenous and local communities and a vast array of species, including African elephants, black rhinos, and cheetahs, live among the vibrant marshlands. Much of the surrounding region is also teeming with wildlife. Fisher Keto hails from Botswana's Waye community and relies on his pole and dugout canoe to skirt around the marshes looking for fish, but things have changed in recent years in the delta and across the country. The fish sizes have shrunk and stocks are declining, Keto, whose life and livelihood depends on the health of the ecosystem. He told this to the international press, saying, quote, the rivers draining into the delta have less volume of water, end quote. Dirt drilling for oil exploration as well as human-caused climate change leading to more erratic rainfall patterns and water abstraction and diversion for development and commercial agriculture has altered the landscape that Keto and so many others, people, wildlife species rely on. The Delta's defenders are now hoping to block at least one of those threats, and that is oil exploration. A planned hearing by Namibia's Environmental Ministry will consider revoking the drilling license of Canadian oil and gas firm Reconnaissance Energy. Local communities and environmental groups claim that land was bulldozed and cut through, damaging lands and polluting water sources without the permission of local communities. And finally, in regard to the development of the security and strategic situation in the Korean Peninsula, a relevant Defense Science Research Institute of the Democratic People's Republic of Korea conducted a test of an underwater strategic weapon system that took place between April 4th and April 7th. The unmanned underwater nuclear attack craft, the Hyul-2, which was deployed for the test at Kajin Port in Kumya County of South Hamgyong Province on the afternoon of April 4th, reached the waters off of Rangunde Port in Tanshan City in South Hamgyong Province, set as the mock target waters on the afternoon of April 7th after cruising along an overland pattern 8 course simulating the distance of 1,000 kilometers in the East Sea of Korea for 71 hours and 6 minutes and correctly set off the test warhead underwater. The test fully verified the reliability and lethal strike capability of the underwater strategic weapon system. The system will serve as a dominant military potential of the armed forces of the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, indispensable for checking all sorts of evolving military action of the enemy and removing their threats and defending the country. With that, we're going to conclude the Pan-African Newswire segment of the Pan-African Journal. In concluding this segment of our program, we would like to remind our listeners that Pan-African Newswire is an international electronic press service. It is designed to foster intelligent discussions on the affairs of African people throughout the continent and the world. The press agency was founded in January of 1998. Since that time, it has published tens of thousands of articles and dispatches in various newspapers, magazines, journals, research reports, and on blogs and websites throughout the world. The Pan-African Newswire represents the only daily international news source on Pan-African and global affairs. If you'd like to log on to the Pan-African Newswire so you can stay abreast of some of the most pressing and burning issues of the day, all you need to do is go to our website, and that is located at panafricannews.blogspot.com. That's panafricannews.blogspot.com. And if you'd like to have access to today's Pan-African Journal special worldwide radio broadcast, just go to the Pan-African Radio Network, and that's at blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. That's blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. Now, these programs can be shared with other potential listeners by merely copying and pasting the links and sending those links to other potential listeners via email. The programs can also be shared by copying and pasting links onto blogs and websites. And the programs can also be shared through social media networks such as Facebook and Twitter. And, of course, this is Abayomi Azikiwe. We'll take a break. We'll be back with more of our program for this week. Welcome back. You're listening to the Pan-African Journal, special worldwide radio broadcast for Sunday, April 9th, 2023. We're broadcasting live from our studios in downtown Detroit, and that was the music of Roy Redman doing his cover of the track entitled Good Day, Sunshine. And, of course, the world is moving towards multipolarity, and, of course, the United States dollar is threatened by the emergence of a multi-currency monetary system. Let's listen to a report on this question of Africa and multi-currency in the world.
This is CGTN, China Global Television Network.
A multi-currency world appears imminent, and the dominance of the U.S. dollar as the global currency of choice may be coming to an end. New developments in the global economic landscape point to this inevitability. This shift has been notable in the BRICS group of countries, where trade using their own currencies has commenced. So, is the dollar in danger of losing its prestigious status? And why do some countries want to break away? I'm Beatrice Marshall. Welcome to Talk Africa. To discuss this issue, let's bring in our panel of experts. In Beijing, Dr. John Gong, Professor of Economics, University of International Business and Economics in Beijing. And joining us from San Francisco, Ryan Patel, Global Business Executive and Senior Fellow, Drucker School of Management, Claremont Graduate University. Gentlemen, a warm welcome to you both. Let me start off with you, Dr. Gong. The U.S. dollar has long been the dominant currency in international trade. However, many countries are looking for alternatives to reduce the dependence on the U.S. dollar. Why are countries beginning to opt out of using the U.S. dollar?
Well, I think the staying away from dollar really started a few years ago when the United States started to impose sanctions on a couple of countries, starting with Iran, for example. So for some time, China's trade with Iran has to be using currencies other than U.S. dollar. And more recently, of course, the sanctions imposed on Russia. And certainly, Russia shut away from the SWIFT system, and about $200 billion of trade between Moscow and Beijing will have to be settled by a currency that is other than U.S. dollar. Now, on top of this, we see more and more signs of other countries, especially resource exporting countries like Saudi Arabia, Brazil, gradually also shifting away to some extent, actually, from U.S. dollar for trade with China and other countries. So I think, there are various reasons for that. And I think the fundamental reasons, again, is that, U.S. weight in the total global trade is actually waning. So I think that's probably the more fundamental reason other than other things. And, of course, Washington's own actions also are propelling many countries to start to stay away from the dollar. Things like sanctions, things like confiscating assets. Things like, I think we would describe as weaponizing the U.S. dollar. So these things certainly also contribute to the winning role of the U.S. dollar in international trade.
Ryan, I want to hear your view here. What's your reaction?
The dollar, I don't think the dollar is going anywhere, but as Professor said, the way that the dollar was looked at obviously is going to be different moving forward. I think one main thing why it is too is the way the technology, the blockchain technology going forward, how it's establishing cross-border financial linkages, that has been something that will support and help regional countries. Like we see it in, the Monetary Authority of Singapore with their Project Guardian, which they're trying to do a test trial last year in November about kind of creating a live transaction cross-country and tokenizing the Singaporean dollar. dollar and the Japanese yen. So when you think about some of these items and you think about how it compares to the U.S. dollar, I don't think the way we look at currency as of 10 years ago to now will change. I think the dollar still will be important to the world, but you know, to your point, will it be what it used to be? I don't think so, just because when you think about how local countries want to use their own currency, and really now there's more of a safer place. Before, it was risk-driven of using certain currencies, but you know, when you can create some trust and credibility in local currencies, I think many governments will look to that way to do that for their citizens.
So, Dr. Gong, I want to get your view here. Is the dollar going to remain as it is? Is this the end of it, or not much is going to change, according to Ryan?
That I totally agree with Ryan. Dollar is going nowhere. I mean, it's not going to go away. It's still going to be very dominant. But I guess the point is that it's not going to be as dominant as it used to be. And we're gradually entering into an era where there are multi-currencies being used. Although the other currencies' weights in international investment and in trade, for example, are still very small. I think a good measure is to look at the weights in the special drawing rights with the IMF, for example. I mean, that's a fairly accurate and also quite objective measure of how important different currencies are. They have a special formula to come up with their weights. And in that, in a special drawing right, the United States dollar is still very dominant. I think it's close to 50%, I think. If I remember this correctly, in the European Union's euro is about 20-some percent. And I think China is a little bit short of 15%. And then you have British pounds and Japanese yen. That's a fairly good picture of how important these currencies are in today's world right now, I think.
Right. So I want to get this from both of you. And Ryan, we heard earlier on from Dr. Gong, and he talked about the various reasons that countries are moving away from the U.S. What, in your view, do you see as a shared grievances among countries that want to break away from the dollar?
Well, I think the thing that we see, or I think in anything, when you put any business leader or any looking at currency, it's about risk, right? I mean, at the end of the day, when you think about how people use different currencies and the way that, even with the way that, other types of currencies being used, they always talk about risk. So I think if someone uses and goes away from the dollar, it's all going to be to their benefit. I think there has been some instability of what you've seen with the Fed, Federal Reserve in the U.S., with hiking interest rates and, being probably not so clear a couple of years ago on what their strategy was in attacking inflation. And so I think we did see some other countries kind of choose to not to want to be a part of that or want to have some stability. So I think the main for me, when I look at it, when we talk about the U.S. dollar, why many countries would move away is obviously it's because of, for them, not being able to pinpoint what the stability looks like moving forward, because in any main currency, you want stability. And so if there's some resistance or some kind of variance between the currency trading between a local currency or where they think it is, I think that's what's been a lot of the moves over the last couple of years to that degree.
So, Dr. Gong, I want to go back to the number of countries that have started moving away gradually, because in recent months, Brazil, Argentina have discussed the creation of a common currency. China and Brazil will trade in national currencies. The UAE and India are in talks to use rupees. Saudi Arabia has said that it is open to trading in currencies besides the U.S. dollar. Most of these deals are bilateral. How exactly is it going to work, and what do you see as the benefits?
Well, it has to start from somewhere, and I think the easiest thing to start from is indeed these bilateral, swap agreements. What it means is that, for example, take the example of China and Brazil. What it means is that, China authorizes the establishment, and also Brazilian government also authorizes the establishment of a local currency, RMB, that's China's currency, clearinghouse in Brazil. I would guess maybe Bank of China's, branch in Brazil or some other bank in Brazil. And what it does essentially is to serve as an offshore market, offshore RMB market, such that trade and also investment, also, personal expenses by Chinese foreigners in Brazil, for example, can be settled in RMB. And there's essentially a local currency market for RMB in these countries. And I think this is a sort of a gradual phased approach. It's probably a more of a realistic and practical solution. You know, after all, I guess a lot of people don't even know that China's currency, RMB, is still very much a capital-controlled currency. I mean, you go to a bank in here in China, asking to exchange for $2,000, that's not going to be a problem. If you're asking for change of, you know, $20 million, that's going to be a problem. So, you know, I think in this way, essentially established a sort of more of an insulated overseas market, offshore market for RMB, with more RMB being used overseas, probably someday, you know, hopefully not so far away, we're going to see the convergence of both markets when capital control here in China can be totally opened up.
So, Ryan, you know, if we're talking about a gradual phased approach, particularly when it comes to bilateral trade deals, and even though it is still early days, how do you think this will work on a multilateral level transaction?
No, that's a great point. I think you got to take baby steps when we see it. But I got one word for you, this technology, right? When I think of what's going on in the fintech side, when you think about startups, you think about companies putting a lot of money to solve this problem, to solve the settlement issue between payments and services and transferring of goods. Before, it was really high percentage would be taken away in transactions when you give foreign exchange rates. Now, because of technology and new startups coming in, they're starting to slow and close that gap. And when you start closing that gap when it comes to that fee, you can start doing these things that are more than just one-to-one. You can change currencies across different currencies and easier than before. And I see that. I see that access is going to happen to consumers, to businesses. And I think more over time, it's going to be a convenience and there's going to be an ability for then companies and businesses and countries and even citizens to choose where they want to have it. Because if you think about it 10 years ago, I don't think we have that much choice of where you want to keep your currency if you want to change it. It was a difficult process. And I think that process is going to change moving forward.
Dr. Gong, what's your reaction? Should the U.S. be concerned here?
Washington is absolutely very concerned about it. I think the prospect of U.S. dollar losing its dominance in the world is going to make a lot of politicians in Washington sleepless. The reason is very simple. United States currency is being used everywhere. While at the same time, United States maintains a huge, huge, gigantic trade deficit with many countries. A couple of $100 billion a year. And, you know, for that, if think about the scenario where the United States has to maintain a foreign exchange reserve to support that trade deficit, that's just, you know, something unimaginable. So right now, it can keep up with that picture by just printing money. I think it's not just the RMB or other currencies. I think the very first day that euro was wrong was something very, very concerned to Washington. I think I can point out to, you know, a couple of actions by the United States to try to curtail the use of the euro in the past. Now we're starting to see more and more other currencies, notably, you know, China's RMB becoming more and more important in international business. So I think this is a scenario that's certainly being very worrisome to a lot of politicians in Washington.
Right. Ryan, I want to look at it from a bit of a geopolitical front here, because it is early days, but, you know, analysts are arguing that the more the U.S. adopts hegemonic means to achieve its purposes, and you know, we heard that from Dr. Gong at the beginning, the more eager the international community will be to get rid of the excessive reliance on the dollar. How do you respond to that?
Well, I mean, I think it's just in general and I think in any situation, when you have all your, I guess the common thing is if you all your eggs in one basket, you want to be able to diversify. And if we've learned anything in the last couple of years, especially with COVID, you know, you want to diversify your risk so you have less risk, and you want to diversify kind of your holdings. And we're seeing that in the banking industry as well. You don't want to be able to put all your money in one place. So I think I can see the ability for diversifying that aspect. I think that there is some worry about, you know, what currency is going to be very stable. And I think we're in early days, not so much just also in, like I mentioned, in what the U.S. dollar is, but the way we use and spend and interact money, to be truthful. This is the second part of the conversation. Mm-hmm. The way we interact in the financial market, you know, from markets to buying stock, is very different in the going forward, and even I can't, you know, predict on what that's going to look like and how that's going to change. And I think that's part of also, when you think about the excitement piece, you would hopefully also mean that, you know, it brings some stability. I use that word because the last thing you want to do, no matter what currency you use, that it is worthless versus it actually being real value.
Dr. Gong, do you see more countries, you know, turning away from the dollar, using their national currencies? I mean, how exactly do you see the U.S. having used its dollar hegemony?
Yeah, I'm starting to see more and more sort of regional deals, multilateral deals. This is a new development. In addition to bilateral agreements, these kind of, swap agreements, we're starting to see more and more regional, multilateral forums talking about this. And I think this is a very important new development, particularly as related to development at the BRICS, for example. If you look at the BRICS countries, the BRICS plus Saudi, I would say, these are all extremely important natural resource exporting countries, right? You're talking about Russia, Saudi Arabia, Brazil, India. These are huge economies, emerging market economies, and when they talk about jointly develop another alternative mechanism for trade using alternative currencies, This is a bombshell for Washington. Mm-hmm. And I think I can imagine Washington would do everything possible to try to prevent that from happening. But it's a very difficult step, by the way. I think when we talk about that, we're talking about RMB or BRICS, so it mm-hmm. could be some other currency. India has its own idea. Saudi probably has its own idea as well. So it's something, pretty easy to start with, but I would imagine, quite difficult to move forward. We have to see what, in concrete terms, what are coming out of the next round of BRICS finance minister meetings and whether they have a really detailed plan for moving things forward. But I would imagine there's a lot of haggling going on at these meetings.
All right, gentlemen, do stay with us because on that note, we're going to take a short break. And when we come back, we'll examine what a multi-currency world would look like and what this means for Africa. To stay with us. Welcome back to Talk Africa. Let's now continue with our discussion. Still with me are in Beijing, Dr. John Gong, Professor of Economics, University of International Business and Economics in Beijing. In San Francisco, Ryan Patel, Global Business Executive and Senior Fellow, Drucker School of Management, Claremont Graduate University. And joining me from Johannesburg, John Foster Pedley, Dean and Director, Henley Business School, Africa. John, if I may start off with you, because in exchange for the dollar, the currencies of many African countries are rather quite weak. When we talk about a multi-currency level here, multi-currency trade with countries trading using their national currencies, how has this impacted trade by African countries in international markets?
Well, I think African countries are fundamentally pragmatic. The importance for them is to get trade done with whoever they can do, without too many transaction costs, without too many inhibitions, and also free of some sense of some political control. The history of Africa is that there's massive domination by different power blocks, and Africans are very skeptical now about people bearing gifts in terms of free aid, etc. So what we need to have is a much broader set of currencies to trade in, or if you're going to stick with the dollar, a very, very flexible dollar that's going to be able to be engaged with across the world. And of course, that isn't going to be attractive to China, mm-hmm. to Russia, to other places who want to have more trade, more influence in their own currencies, and the ability to be faster and more agile. So I think you've got an open scenario in Africa now, a land of opportunity, where those who come with good deals, good currency mixes, and allow people in those countries to do trade easily, and that's the particular secret, easy trade, you're going to see the African countries going towards them rather agnostically of historic political influence.
But John, what are the potential opportunities and risks here for a multi-currency world for Africa?
Well, I think the opportunities are, it gives you flexibility, it gives you the possibilities of having quicker trade, it gives you freedom from some of the old power blocks and the old power influences that might have dominated Africa in the past. The risks are, of course, more volatility, more uncertainty, being caught up in the wrong basket of currencies, if you like. So it comes with a need for increased management and increased skills in managing across borders with the money. So, of course, there are many attractions, but I have to say there are many risks, and I don't want to underestimate those risks, because if we do, we will be selling people the opportunity of doing multicultural business very easily, whereas, in fact, what we need to do is give people the skills, the training, the background, and the systems and the institutions that are going to allow them to trade more flexibly. And that is what Africa needs. It needs help with education, needs help with institutions, it needs help with building their prosperity, and it needs to be remove away from these extractive forms of trade that you could argue that single currency denomination trade facilitates. We don't want to replace it with another type. So my answer is that if you want to do good business in Africa, mm-hmm. International business in Africa, then help people learn how to use these currencies. And don't think they're necessarily easy to slip into.
Dr. Gong, this is an interesting implication here, because China is now Africa's leading trade partner. What is the implication of all of this for Africa? How will African countries benefit from the increased use of alternative currencies for trading or investment?
There are some countries in the world right now that are heavily reliant upon the United States dollar, or that are in big trouble right now. Countries like Sri Lanka, Turkey, these are examples of taking the consequences of the Fed in the United States raising interest rate. What it means is that the dollar is becoming more expensive, worsening of the balance of payments in these countries, there's massive capital exodus from these countries back to the United States, and the local currency is depreciating pretty heavily. There's a saying, said by somebody in the Treasury Department some time ago, that it is our money and that's your problem, right? So I think at least by offering another alternative, that is RMB, I think many African countries are at least immune from this type of difficulties as a result of the tightening of interest rates in Washington. I think there's a lesson learned here that on one hand, moving away from these one single currency is takes some risk, as John has alluded to earlier. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, I think it also lessens the over reliance upon a single currency, which can be subject to this kind of a financial risks as a result of interest rate rises in the United States.
Ryan, that whole question of over-reliance and perhaps Africa could be immune to some of the difficulties when it, of global trade. But let's talk about the ways in which this multi-currency dispensation can address some of the unfairness. Could it address some of the unfairness and inequalities that exist in the global financial system as currently constituted?
Well, that's a great question. I think there's a multitude of steps that has to be able to do that. And, again, another thing I would say would be technology, right? The swiftness, the easiness, the convenience to be able to do that, that it has to occur should it want to be successful to do that. But then you ask the question, so is that being able to pinpoint and make it easy for people to trade and have that ability to be worth something, mm-hmm. is that a multi-currency currency occurring? Is that something that occurs, and what currency does it do that? Is it a digital asset, right? So the way we look at that, again, will be very different when you think about transferring different between different bank accounts. And so to be successful, it has to do this with, these other things of that trust, that ability that has to occur. It cannot just be, hey, we've got all these, we have alternatives, but they're not equally the same, right? You want to be able to have that trust in that aspect of that value, so you know what you're getting yourself into, that there isn't that much of a risk. I think it goes back to that question of convenience and being able to do that.
So, John, what sort of measures, you know, when we talk about the convenience, what sort of measures do you see African countries taking, or can African countries take, to make the most of these new developments and reduce their over-reliance on the U.S. dollar?
Well, I think there's an awful lot of training and development to be done. I mean, while we can talk about theory and what we can do in institutions, the big challenge is always talent in Africa, talent capability. We have an education deficit in Africa. We have very smart people. And if you want to get people to engage in this, then help with education, help with development. I know that's not the economic argument nor the currency argument, but that is the real thing we need to do to capacitate people in Africa to do this. Because what we need to do is build prosperity in Africa, not just another alternative, very high Gini coefficient, another elite. And I think that's the big thing. So if you come into Africa with those mentalities, you're going to get a warm welcome and people will engage with it. Also, I think you've got to accept currencies more readily. Sure, the volatility in Iran, the volatility in Brazilian currencies, etc. But you need to have those currencies more readily traded, more available to you. So that's really important as well. You've also got to really engage in anti-money laundering and anti-terrorism activities around finance. South Africa has just been grey-listed by the TATF. That grey listing is a significant burden on companies trading within South Africa. Help with that. Be very clear on your legislation and on your clarity of your quality assurance around anti-money laundering. Now, this isn't always attractive to people who want to come into Africa and build businesses and going around the regulation, but that is not a long-term and sustainable position for Africa. And I want to advocate for Africa now with multinational, with international organizations and countries, that you do come into Africa with a development mentality, not an extractive mentality. I have to say that is the most important thing that you can do if you want to get traction in Africa.
All right, so I want to get your final comments as we wind down the program. And John Foster, let me start off with you here. How do you see a multi-currency world and a multipolar world developing? Do you think it is necessary to introduce an alternative to the U.S. dollar as a standard currency?
I think there's an inevitability. Obviously, if you talk to China and the Chinese government, they would like to see yuan take over that role or be a multiple currency. Other countries in Asia would like to see their currencies take hold. So I think what you're seeing is a changing in power dynamics internationally.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to advocate for one or the other. I'm just saying the natural process of evolution will see more flexible use of currencies, more resourceful, more imaginative use of currencies, more options, more flexibilities, more freedom of trade emerging through financial instruments and financial changes. I think that's an inevitability, but it's a bit like AI. It's not that you will be replaced by AI. Your job will be replaced by somebody who knows how to use AI.
Mm-hmm.
So when it comes to the financial markets and instruments as well, what will happen is those people who know how to use these financial instruments, know how to use them for development, will be the people who will be in the pole and leading position in the future. If you're looking for global domination in one way or the other, that's not an honorable target. If you're looking for developing people internationally and helping people grow their potential, that is an honorable target, and that's what we should aim for.
Dr. Gong, how do you see a multi-currency world and a multi-polar world developing?
Well, we are seeing it's developing. It's a small step right now. Should I say it's going to be a small step by a few countries? Should I say that it's a giant leap for mankind? It's something unstoppable in my view. And I think it's going to gradually move towards that direction. But let's also be very realistic here that U.S. dollar is still going to play a very dominant role for a long, long time.
Ryan, you have the final word.
Well, if I had to say anything, we're in it together, and I would hope that the global financial system and currency, we need each other to be able to have that trade to make societies better and countries together. So I would hope that, naturally in the future that there is going to be more work together, and maybe you can call me, I'm too hopeful, but I'm hoping that institutions and governments and countries come together to be able to prop that stability.
Gentlemen, thank you very much indeed for a very insightful discussion. But that's all we have time for on this edition of Talk Africa. A big thank you to my panel of experts in Johannesburg, John Foster Pedley, Dean and Director, Henley Business School Africa. In Beijing, Dr. John Gong, Professor of Economics, University of International Business and Economics in Beijing. And in San Francisco, Ryan Patel, Global Business Executive and Senior Fellow, Drucker School of Management, Claremont Graduate University. Remember, you can be a part of this conversation through our social media platforms on Facebook and Twitter, and you can watch this and other editions of Talk Africa on our YouTube playlist. Do join us again next week for more Talk Africa. For me, Beatrice Marshall, and the team here in Nairobi, until next time, bye-bye.
Welcome back. That was Beatrice Marshall from Nairobi, Kenya, speaking and interviewing people on the movement towards multi-currency in Africa and around the world. You're listening to the Pan-African Journal, special worldwide radio broadcast. Today is Sunday, April 9th, 2023. And we're broadcasting live from our studios in downtown Detroit. We'll take a break. We'll be back with more of the Pan-African Journal special worldwide radio broadcast for this week. Welcome back, and that was Little Sister with the track entitled Somebody's Watching You, and of course, we're here watching you at the Pan-African Journal, special worldwide radio broadcast, and we're broadcasting live from our studios in downtown Detroit on this Sunday, April 9th, 2023. Chris Honey, a leading figure in the South African National Liberation Movement, was martyred 30 years ago today. And, of course, we are going to pay tribute to Chris Honey. He was assassinated in a plot by right-wing elements in the Republic of South Africa during the transition process from apartheid to a multi-party democracy. On April 10th, 1993, in Boksburg, in South Africa, Chris Honey was out jogging, doing morning exercise when he was assassinated by Jacob Vallas, who was part of a broader right-wing conspiracy to derail the transitional process. We're going to listen to an interview with the widow of Chris Hani. This interview was done when the South African Constitutional Court granted parole to Jacob Vallas just 4 months ago in the Republic of South Africa. Let's listen to this discussion with Paul Hani.
Staying with that story, Hani's wife, Dimpo, has described yesterday's ruling by the Constitutional Court as diabolical. These were her comments shortly after that ruling was handed down. Ms. Hani, good evening. Thank you so much for coming into studio. We all saw the visuals of just how, it's really not angry, how outraged you were following this ruling yesterday. You've had about 24 hours to reflect on the events. How are you feeling tonight?
I wish I'm feeling much better, but it's better than how I felt yesterday. Yesterday, let me start by saying, Kathy, I have walked this road, and anybody who has not lost a loved one the way my husband was murdered will never understand. So I've had people who are saying whatever they were saying, but I want to say to them, it's about me. It's not about anybody. It's about me. It's about the Hani family. It's not about my children. Their opinions, they can keep them to themselves because they have not experienced what I have experienced. I know I'm one of the privileged South Africans in the sense that the man who murdered my husband was arrested. But there are many women out there who up to today don't know who killed their partners. In that respect, I'm lucky. However, going back to yesterday, what upset me most was it was like I was the one who was in court, you know, and Wallace was treated by Judge Zondo as a victim, and it was over an hour, he was going on and on and on and on and on, but what I found sad, in everything that he said, at no time did Justice Zondo refer to my pain, to the broader Hani family pain, and my children's pain. And I want to make an assumption that all those men and women who are sitting there have got families. But there was something about them. I looked at their faces that were cold. You know, I've had people saying something leaves them cold. All of them, they were extremely cold. And I thought, oh, fine, they're doing their job. But I want to say there's something that taught me. I learned something yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we have people deployed in different positions. Now, not everybody would have been in the struggle. Okay. There are people who remained at home, they did their own contribution, there are those who were in Robben Island, those who were in camps. But there's something that I picked up. People who during the struggle were studying and they were never interested in the struggle. Now they've been given these positions on a platter, literally, by the sacrifices of South Africans. As a result, they have no appreciation of the suffering that this nation has gone through, especially the black people, our Indian people, and the colored people. So I would appeal to whoever deploys these people that when they have interviews, they should check if they've got hearts, what I experienced yesterday, it reminded me like I was sitting in front of her foot.
Mm-hmm.
Seriously.
There was a
subtle hostility with all of them. Now, what was interesting, Judge Zondo says, we all agreed on this judgment, and I wrote it. Mark that one. I wrote it. But as she was reading, whoever was watching, you could tell the man was struggling to read. How do you write something and you struggle to read what you wrote? That was my observation. Maybe he was, I don't know, whatever.
Is it fair for you to say that, and these are the highest judges of this country at the Constitutional Court, is it fair for you to say that they are in those positions that have been handed to them on a platter when all of
some
us
of them.
As South Africans see the process that they all have to undergo to be able to even be nominated to those positions?
I don't want to talk about fairness. Here I'm saying my views.
Mm.
All I'm saying is whoever interviews them, they should choose people who are not heartless. For instance, I was never warned, you know, it's just that I'm strong. When he says, he says, I'll give the minister instructions that within 11 days the man should have gone. If I was a weak person, I don't know how the law works. I would have fainted. And I thank my God that I didn't faint. And talking about fairness, all I'm asking is, we have gone through the most painful period.
Mm.
I don't say they should love me, they should favor me. They've got their law books, they're doing their work. But I've got a problem with hostility, subtle hostility. That's my problem.
Is it subtle hostility, or actually before I get to that, have you had an opportunity to either read the judgment or even the summary of the judgment?
I haven't read it.
Mm-hmm.
I was sitting in court and I was concentrating.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
No, I'm just asking post yesterday, you know, has that moment arisen at all?
I'll do that my own time.
All right.
Yeah.
So when one reads the court judgment, it, number one, outlines the case that was brought forth by Yanus Walus, and around why it is that he feels that his rights, his constitutional rights, are being trampled on because he is effectively now made to be a perpetual prisoner, which is not in line with the country's constitution. It acknowledges the submissions that were made by yourself and the SACP as interested parties in the matter, and the argument that you make around how you believe this case is exceptional simply because of what was happening in South Africa at the time and the fact that he, by assassinating your husband, effectively sought to shake the core of what was the foundation for a democratic South Africa. Despite that acknowledgement, it finds that consideration does not outweigh the Constitution, that there must be the idea of equality before the law for everybody.
I agree with you, Kathy.
Mm-hmm.
You are 100% correct. But I'll give you an example. We woke up one day, former President Zuma was sentenced by the same court for 15 months without a hearing. Is that democracy? Is that constitutional? I want you to answer me.
Well, it was a ruling out of the Constitutional Court.
I don't have a problem.
We have to say that it's constitutional.
I don't have a problem. But my concern is, do you sentence somebody without hearing his side of the story? Is that what the South African Constitution says? Is it fair? If we talk about fairness, let's cover everything. Let's not be selective. It happened, we are all there, when Mr. Zuma was sentenced to 15 months without a hearing.
So then what are your views of the Constitutional Court then?
I don't want to talk about the Constitutional Court. I'm not part of the Constitutional Court, but I think there are lots of things which, in my view, have to be changed.
Such as?
Such as the laws that are being used are apartheid laws. You know, they're old laws. I don't know why Parliament has not looked at them, but I think it's high time we did. And also I'll tell you, Judge Zondo did not refer to TRC. He didn't. Well, I guess maybe there were too many things he had to cover, and he didn't have time to cover the TRC hearing, where Walus was hostile, literally hostile. Okay, Walus is out. That's okay. Life moves on. But all I'm appealing, you know, Lindiwe Sisulu raised this thing about judges. And I must say I'm one of the people who felt, no, Comrade Lindiwe, you can't say that about judges. But let's say judges are human beings. Now, what I've noticed after yesterday, for the first time, we have put them on some pedestal that they're not human. They are perfect. As a result, they also behave the same way, that they're above everything else. While I appreciate the fact, can I finish, please?
Sure.
While I appreciate the fact that, according to South African Constitution, that's the last bus stop, I don't have a problem with that. I don't have a problem with the Constitution. But if you can look at most things, the people who are suffering are mostly black people. And I believe the work of the Constitutional Court is to assist this country to move forward, as Comrade Pule said, you know, without all these tensions based on color. That's how I understand their role should be. That's my view, anyway.
I'm listening to what you're saying. I'm also bearing in mind the fact that in 2015, we had Eugene de Kock, who was released on parole. And during the Zondo Commission of Inquiry, it would then come to light that he was not only receiving protection, he was living in a state house, if I can put it that way, but was also receiving money that was effectively being sponsored by the state. It was coming out of the state coffers. And I'm thinking about the victims of the atrocities he committed, because we all know what the history said around him as well. And when we think about the kind of justice system that we have chosen as a country, we've opted to go for a more restorative justice than simply a retributive justice. Are you saying that that needs to change? That there shouldn't be the option where somebody who has committed crimes must be given the opportunity to not be behind bars?
Okay, let me take you back to the first court case. That time it was during apartheid times. When I went to court, David Lewis and Walus were sentenced to death. Okay. Now the ANC comes into power and they abolished the death penalty. They were sentenced to life imprisonment. Okay. Now, my personal view is the magistrate or judges, whoever they are, they should be specific when they sentence somebody that I'm giving you life sentence without parole. They have failed to do that. As a result, people are being killed in South Africa. Police, everybody's being killed. You know, this crime in South Africa has no color. Everybody's getting killed. And the killers know that after X number of years, I'll get parole. So I think it is the responsibility of the justice system when they sentence these people to say life without parole. I think if they can just work on that one, then I'm sure we'll be going somewhere. Because, you know, what is happening out there, people are being killed like flies. You know, if you have doom, you doom flies, you know, in your house. Because they know they will never serve life. They will never serve 20 years or whatever because they're entitled to the parole. So I think that might assist.
So then, given your acknowledgement of where the law is right now, that prisoners are entitled to parole, do you feel that what the Constitutional Court did was wrong, or was it simply acting within the parameters of the law as it exists currently?
They were doing their job. I don't have a problem. They were doing their job and they paid very well for it. Yeah, that's my comment.
Have you and your family had a conversation about the possibility, as opposed even before yesterday, now it's no longer a possibility, it's a reality of Janusz Walus being released?
They can release him, they've decided already.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm told he's the highest court in the land, so they've decided.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so what was the question?
Have you discussed this, how you're going to deal with that moment, the significance of it for
Zondo
you?
Zondo has decided for us.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, judgment has been passed. The final, they have a final say.
Mm-hmm.
So they've decided. So what's there to discuss?
Mm-hmm.
Nothing. Except what hit me was the fact that, let me tell you what hit me. I don't know how many times I've responded to the so-called letter of forgiveness.
Mm-hmm.
I was not in South Africa. I was in Cuba when the so-called letter, I'm told, the letter was written. And I have given interviews where I said, my lawyer has never seen the letter. I've never seen the letter. And the emphasis of Mr. Zondo yesterday was, it was quite interesting, I must say. It was like a headmaster, you know, in a primary school. He says, Walus wrote me a letter. I ignored the letter. Walus asked for forgiveness, and I refused to forgive him. Guess what, Kathy? I want to tell everybody, it is my right. Nobody's going to forgive me, to force me to forgive Walus. He took my husband away. Why am I being forced to forgive him? If the Constitutional Court wants to forgive him, that's their baby. But I should not be accused. He portrayed me as this woman who is unreasonable. And guess what? Because none of them has experienced what I've experienced and many other South Africans. So to them, it's theory, it's law books. There are no emotions involved.
Mm.
And I respect that. But it's so sad because, you know, in life, like, I'll repeat it, there is karma. Don't ever do something bad to somebody. It's going to come back hundredfold. I don't wish for it. But God works in mysterious ways. Because now there I was, Walus is a victim, I'm this bad woman, Walus is being reasonable, asking for forgiveness, blah, 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 blah.
Mm.
Really? I'm an adult. And I have the right you know?
Sure.
I have the right to say, Kathy, I will not forgive you.
Mm.
The pain is felt by me, not by the Constitutional Court. Well, they will come to judge me. So what?
What
have
you
moved on.
What do you think the next 10 days are going to be like for you and your family?
I couldn't give it. I don't care. I've reached a point where I don't care.
Mm.
Yeah. Because I know what I'm dealing with now. You know, when you move into a situation and you are moving into it innocently, it sort of shakes you. It happened yesterday. I reacted, but I'm fine. I don't know until I'm okay. And my children are okay. And the Hari family is okay. It was painful. It was. I don't want to lie.
Mm.
Especially the surprise element. I don't know what the law says. Maybe it says you should just say whatever you have to say. It's okay. I'm fine.
Mm.
I've learned how the Concord works in South Africa. I've learned. I can write a book about it.
All right.
Just for one day hearing.
Mm.
Yeah.
Mam Dimpo, I wish you and your family strength over the next 10 days. It's going to be a difficult period, unquestionably, and I hope that you will be able to get through.
But what I would like to say before you are summarizing now.
Yes.
Okay. Before you summarize, I would like to say in 1968, a man called Sehan killed in cold blood Robert F. Kennedy. In 69, he was sentenced to life. This happened in California.
Mm.
In January this year, now you can imagine from 69 to 2022, he applied for parole. And he was denied parole by the Californian governor. And I want to quote him. This is what he said. After carefully reviewing the case, including record in the California State Archives, I have determined that Sehan has not developed the accountability and insight required to support his side on the release into the community. All I'm saying is, we need political will. That's what lacks in South Africa. In the Jewish people, up to today, they're still pursuing the people who did the Holocaust.
Mm.
What's wrong with me? Or is it because I'm not white? What's wrong with me saying this is wrong? When it's happening in other countries, I think, and these people who are in power, they travel all over the world. Why can't they learn good things that are being done there?
Mm.
So I just wanted to say it's happening in other countries. This Sehan, from 69, in January they still refused him parole.
Mm.
So we lack political will in South Africa.
All right. We'll have to leave it there for tonight.
Thank you, ma'am.
Thank you so much for making the trip and
thank
coming
you very
to
much,
the studio.
Ma'am. Thank
I
you.
Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Dimpo Hali there, and yeah. You heard for yourself exactly where she stands in as far as this matter is concerned.
Welcome back. And that was an interview with the widow of Chris Honey, who tomorrow will represent the 30th anniversary of his assassination in South Africa on April 10th of 1993. And you're listening to the Pan-African Journal, worldwide radio broadcast, and we're broadcasting live from our studios in downtown Detroit. And we'll be back with more of our program for this week. And, you're listening to the Pan-African Journal, special worldwide radio broadcast. Thank you.
amateur, my smile is a mess. Think about it. Did you hear me?
Welcome back, and that was Detroit's own Temptations with the track entitled Smiling Faces from Motown Records. And we're going to move into a further tribute to Paul Leroy Robeson. This is a lecture by his son, Paul Robeson Jr., on the lifetimes and contributions of Paul Robeson.
Our host for this program, Mr. Paul Robeson, Jr.
Thank you very much. Good evening. We invite you to share with us the joy and pain, the challenge and excitement of the greatest moments in my father's life. Although Paul Robeson was extraordinarily multi-talented, He was best known throughout the world as a great singer. And more than anything else, it is his music that will continue to live on after him. So it is appropriate to touch briefly on the sources of his musical genius. There was his formidable talent. There was his consummate acting ability and dramatic power. There was also his spiritual commitment, his attitude toward his talent. As a young man of 32, he said, "The talents of an artist are God-given. Having been given, I must give. Man shall not live by bread alone, and what the farmer does, I must do. I must feed the people with my songs." And there was his meticulous and constant scholarship. He studied languages and cultures, and he analyzed his music and lyrics in minute detail so that they flowed effortlessly whenever he sang. Because Paul Robeson was such a great artist, his social activism carried an enormous impact. He was, and still is, controversial because he challenged the cultural foundations of racism in America. He was, and he remains, the symbol of the black man who uncompromisingly insists on full equality. As he put it, "I am looking for freedom, full freedom, not an inferior brand." One of his greatest contributions was to fight unceasingly to make it acceptable for artists, especially black artists, to take a stand on social issues. He believed they had not only a right, but also the responsibility to speak out according to their consciences. He wrote, "The artist must elect to fight for freedom or for slavery. I have made my choice. I had no alternative." The film you are about to see, Paul Robeson Tribute to an Artist, captures the essence of Paul Robeson. Written and directed by Saul Terrell, narrated by Sidney Poitier, it is a labor of respect and love which speaks for itself. Come with me, then, to look through this window on black history so that together we may be enriched by the unforgettable nobility of Paul Robeson. Those who wish to ask questions, if you'd find the usher nearest to you, they will bring you to the microphones one by one. But I want to say that just, although I've seen this film very many times, I'm always deeply moved whenever I see it. Then it takes me a little while to collect my thoughts. So please feel free to ask any questions you might have on your minds. I hope that some of the old and dear friends of the Robeson family who are here tonight, as well as others who have encountered my father, will share with us briefly some of their recollections.
As a voice and speech coach, Paul Robeson has been a role model for my students for many, many years. And I wondered if you could give us some insight into from the point of view of phrasing and diction, what was going on in his head and heart as he spoke the words of the great poets like the Roman orators and Disraeli and Keats?
You ask the easy ones, I see. Okay, I'll take a crack at that on a couple of levels. He learned Othello in four languages: French, German, Russian, Yiddish. Why? The French, when he's talking about Desdemona, French is almost like a caress, one level. The German for a certain militaristic, a certain sharpness when he's talking about the wars of Cyprus. The Russian because certain musical tones give an extra impetus to a line. And they gave him the idea of where to emphasize a line. It's a very musical up and down language. Yiddish for the humor, because Othello is a heavy, heavy, heavy play. You got to lighten up sometime. He felt that he should find out where Shakespeare got his language from. So he went back to the ancient Anglo-Saxon, from which the Elizabethan came, studied the ancient Anglo-Saxon. Then he studied the role in the Elizabethan language that Shakespeare actually wrote in. Finally, he studied the ancient Moorish culture, the ancient Venetian culture, put all that together, and that was the result of his memorable performance, still considered the performance of Othello this century.
Paul, as you know, many of us are aware of your father's great exploits in athletics. But there's still one great social injustice, which you and I both know about, which I will mention now. That is that Paul Robeson, one of the greatest football players of all time, is not in the College Football Hall of Fame.
I would add one fact to Dr. Brown's comments about my father's prowess. He was an All-American for 2 years, and if you can imagine him standing 6 feet, 3.5, 220 pounds, could run the 100-yard dash in 11 seconds flat in the high-top shoes, could throw the forward pass, was one of the greatest middle linebackers of all time, was the prototype type tight end, and ran the end around and was able to pass from running the end around. He also played, interestingly enough, in the first professional Super Bowl in history for Akron against the Chicago Bears in 1922. Rutgers University has repeatedly sponsored my father. Many institutions, individuals have supported his entry into the Hall of Fame, but since the Board of Trustees of the College Hall of Fame, it is a private institution, and that board is extremely conservative. It is doubtful that any public pressure can do anything more than embarrass them. My own feeling is that they're so conservative that until there is a new board, they won't induct my father for both racial and political reasons.
I graduated from Columbia Law School, and I just discovered several years ago that Paul Robeson graduated from Columbia Law School, and there was a feat for him here at Columbia, and Dean Albert Rosenthal was asked why so long, why did it take so long to have a ceremony, and he said, well, it wasn't as if you met him at alumni functions.
Dean Rosenthal was being, let's say, overly subtle. The fact is that for years the Columbia trustees would not have allowed Dean Rosenthal to mention my father's name or any other dean of Columbia University. In fact, the legal profession, including the best legal minds at Columbia at that time, found it easy to acquiesce in the illegal deprivation, in the illegal confiscation of my father's passport by the State Department. They suddenly found that the Constitution didn't apply to Paul Robeson. I'm quite sure that they would not like to recall those rather infamous times and would prefer to simply say that they've rediscovered my father.
Who were the major influences of your father during this time, those thinkers or scholars that best reflect the mission and the aspiration as espoused by your father during his leadership? Thank you.
All right, the first, perhaps the most important influence on my father was his father, a runaway slave, who was fought with the Union Army, educated himself, and became a minister in Princeton and Somerville, New Jersey. He's a man of great dignity, and Dad said of him that he had an even more resonant bass voice than he did. He learned from my grandfather the art of speaking. My grandfather was a great orator. It's an ancient West African tradition. And my father grew up in the church and learned the art of speaking. We also got several principles from my grandfather, and those were briefly, first, be the best that you can possibly be. Secondly, success in itself has no meaning unless you move ahead, are a trailblazer for your oppressed people. And finally, perhaps most important of all, be true to your principles. He studied African languages, cultures, and found the connections between African culture and the Afro-American cultural tradition here. He met many African and Asian leaders, including Nnamdi Azikiwe of Nigeria and Jomo Kenyatta, the Burning Spear, the first president of Kenya. All these leaders had a great influence on my father because it was there that he found his African roots.
Mr. Robeson, is there a contradiction with Paul Robeson being seen on one hand as a forerunner of the Black Power movement and at the same time being seen as an integrationist?
Good question. I think the problem is in part with the definitions, as if there are only two things, either black liberation or an integrationist. The fact is, my father, being a very wise man, took the best from both concepts. In brief, he was opposed to separatism because he believed that there was no future for blacks in the United States with an attempt to produce and create a separate economy and political system as a minority within the United States. On the other hand, he firmly believed in independence, political and cultural independence within the black community, that their leaders should be totally independent of any outside control, and that, as he put it, the Negro power, forerunner of black power, should be the source of strength to enable black Americans as a group to contend for and achieve political and economic equity in the United States, not only civil rights. As he put it, civil rights is only the first step on the road to equal opportunity and an equal share, an equitable share.
Before I ask my question, I'm another member of the Paul Robeson Interns, sponsored by Mahan Valley. And from seeing this film, I see where the youth group got its name, because your father has achieved a lot, and the staff of Mahan Valley is all about making us achieve our goals and not letting us turn back or give up. And my question is that, what were some of the subjects that your father spoke for or against that they took away his passport?
Yeah, very good question, because interestingly enough, the State Department's brief mentioned in almost in passing his radicalism and so on, but picked out one essential thing in terms of his passport. They said, in effect, anybody should be able to understand what an enormous problem it would be for the United States of America for this recognized leader of the Negro people to be traveling abroad urging and demanding and supporting independence for the colonial peoples of Africa and Asia. Any idiot should understand why we can't give the man a passport for that.
Would you happen to know, like, what motivated your father to take, you know, his belief so far?
I think that his determination, it came from his belief in a principle that you do what is right, not what is expedient. One example, when he came back in 1949 from Europe after having made those speeches, specifically the one at the Paris Peace Conference, he was told
by an old friend who was really speaking for the State Department, in effect that if he would be willing to stop making speeches, didn't have to take anything back, just stop making speeches, that in a year or so everything would be quieted down and he would be forgiven, he could have his own television show, anything he wanted. If he did not, the message was, Paul, you're going to need life insurance, not career insurance. He decided to continue the way he was going. That was the way he was.
This is a question more nearly about American culture than it is about Paul Robeson. There's a continuing perception that, for example, Paul Robeson went into self-exile in the Soviet Union for a long period of time. There's also the view that Paul Robeson was somehow nearly a traitor when he expressed views that were not very different than those that the NAACP had expressed during World War II. Yet these views persist, and I wondered if you wanted to comment on that.
I think that is important because perhaps the biggest myth that the establishment and its media have spread about my father, that he was a disillusioned exile, self-exiled to the Soviet Union. I think that's the standard phraseology. Nothing could be further from the truth. The fact is that he was locked inside the United States for 9 years, even prevented from traveling to countries where you don't need a passport, like Mexico, Alaska, Hawaii. He was confined to the continental United States by special presidential order, unprecedented for someone not under indictment, which he certainly was not. So he was locked in, not out, and it's fair to say that when he was abroad, his base was always in London, not in the Soviet Union. He traveled to the Soviet Union often, visited often, but he always lived in London when he was abroad, the center of the English-speaking theater, quite natural. Finally, he was ill for the last 15 years of his life, but unbowed. As a matter of fact, he rejoiced in seeing on television and elsewhere thousands of people saying and doing what he was persecuted for 10 and 20 years earlier. As a matter of fact, one of his last messages, he said, and I quote, I want you to know that I am the same Paul, dedicated as ever to the worldwide cause of humanity for freedom, peace, and brotherhood. Now, the reason for the myth is that a black man who challenges the cultural foundations of racism must become the black sheep who returns crestfallen and asks forgiveness.
Mr. Robeson, I understand your father visited the Soviet Union in the 1930s. Could you please tell us what his impressions were of the USSR of the 1930s?
He visited the Soviet Union often, the 1930s and 1940s and 1950s. His initial impression was primarily cultural. He came at the invitation of Sergei Eisenstein, a great Russian filmmaker, who wanted to do a film called Black Majesty about the great Haitian liberator Toussaint Louverture. My father spoke Russian by then, and people had heard his singing over the radio in Russian. So he was popular because of his voice. They knew who he was. Also, he found himself accepted without a tinge of racism. And the most impressive thing about the Soviet Union that he found was that they encouraged the flowering of all of the cultures of the Soviet Union rather than the melting pot theory, or what is often called in black circles as the integrationism, everyone must be homogenized. I think that was the most important feature of the Soviet Union to him at that time. And I think that what made him controversial is that because his view that the interests of black people in the United States and the colored and colonial peoples throughout the world were his primary, always his primary concern, he came to the conclusion that the communist world were their allies in the struggle against imperialism and colonialism. He was outspoken about his radical political views. He made no secret of the fact that he saw a great deal of merit in Marxism, socialism, communism, whatever you want to call it. He certainly was not a member of any party, the Communist Party or any other party. He was not a communist in that sense, but he always thought that the name communist was an honorable one. And when McCarthyism came, he refused to abandon his communist friends or the ideological beliefs that paralleled or agreed with those of communists or socialists. Unlike many others in the United States who suspended the Constitution when it came to socialists, communists, etc. Constitution is either for everybody, or as people found out under McCarthyism, everybody loses some rights if somebody loses some rights.
It seems to me, I'm not exactly sure the dates, that your father first went to Russia in the 1930s.
Mm-hmm. 1934, to be precise.
Was he aware of the tremendous suppression of Russian visual and performing artists in the 20s? I'm talking about people like Malevich and many of the actors, painters, writers, which I know has been kept tremendously from Russian people, because I've talked to some Russian performing artists today and they didn't know that. Was he aware of their complete suppression of their avant-garde movements and their other experimental movements?
When my father went in the early 1930s, still 1934, it corresponded with an enormous flowering of Soviet culture, in particular the cultures of the minorities. So he was very much focused on the positives and was not aware of the history you speak of and of the history to come. Because of his commitment and his feeling that the interests of blacks and the colored peoples of the world were primary, although he was aware of the purges of the 1930s, not in their totality, of course, he chose not to criticize the Soviet Union because he did not think it would be in the interests of blacks, the liberation movements around the world, which the Russians at the time counterbalanced Western imperialism. So it was a judgment call. He did have, if you want to call it that, priorities in the things he undertook. Some people think that was a mistake. History will have to judge that.
I met Paul Robeson in 1940 at the University of Wisconsin when he came to sing at the Union Memorial Hall at Madison, Wisconsin. He was a giant of a man then and has remained a giant in my mind and a hero of mine since meeting him personally at that time. In addition to being a great athlete, in addition to being a great singer, he was a man of peace, and he had fought for world peace. And he, with Ben Spock and W.E.B. Du Bois and a whole raft of people who spoke for peace in the 50s, was a victim of what was then called McCarthyism. And the need for recognizing the need to fight for world peace is something that Paul Robeson gave to me as a young man. And today, as much as it was before, there is a need for understanding and detente with the Soviet Union, which is the big issue that Paul Robeson fought for, and that's what we all have to continue to fight for. And we have to use that spirit and that man's tradition and history for our own purposes in our own way.
I think if he were here, he would want us to learn from his example as a person of conscience, and figure out what we ought to do according to our own consciences. Because one thing he taught me above all else, and I was a mature man before I realized what a debt I owed him for that, is he taught me first and foremost to be my own person. Don't copy anybody else. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you again for coming. I hope you enjoyed your visit with my father. Thank you.
Welcome back, and that was a lecture by Paul Robeson Jr. entitled Paul Robeson, Man of Conscience. And of course, here's another lecture by Paul Robeson Jr. entitled The State of Repression of Paul Robeson.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon. I'd like to try to put my father's persecution in a context to show the continuity between then and now. I can speak with some authority because I've also been a target of both COINTELPRO and MKUltra. Been more fortunate than most. I'm still here and healthy. Most people who have had that experience are no longer with us. In terms of a context, the people who did that to my father and to me are part of what I call the permanent government. They have been here since before the Civil War. They were responsible for the assassination of Lincoln, of Kennedy, and many, many more. They have been responsible for starting wars, for covert operations that have tried to start wars. They have been involved in assassinations of foreign diplomats and heads of state, and on and on and on. Contrary to the mythology, the most important part of that secret government is run out of a secret operation in the Defense Department, out of Defense Intelligence, which gets 80% of the budget. That's where the ball game is. That's why the 9/11 Commission focused on a czar who would extract the budget and control from the Defense Department. The CIA is small stuff. However, they're coordinated, and the real dirty work is done by something called the Field Operations Unit of Military Intelligence. Now, those people are around because they come from a special segment of the American population since before the Civil War. They belong to a specific ethnic group and a regional group. They are part of an elite in this country that used to call itself the WASP Ascendancy. The ethnic designation is English and German, otherwise known as Anglo-Saxon. They used to call themselves WASPs, but that's no longer in vogue. They have a predominantly southern center of gravity, wealthy, and fundamentalist Protestant. WASP stands for White Anglo-Saxon Protestant. Since Anglo-Saxons are already white, that's double white Protestant, meaning super white. They are the cousins, if not the brothers, in constituency and culture of Hitler's Nazis out of southern Germany, specifically. Down around Bavaria and Austria is where Hitler came from. That's the core of the Nazi tradition. And the cultures and outlooks of the tradition of Hitler in Germany and the Confederacy in the United States are almost identical. And if you read Mein Kampf, you will read Hitler's compliments to, you know, if the Americans get their stuff together and go Confederate-wise, they'll be just like us. Now, that's hidden, and nobody talks about ethnicity in this country for that very reason. They were the core of the slave owners. And let's say I have a special bias against them because I happen to be the grandson of not just a slave, but a field slave. And that's some difference between a freedman and a house slave and a skilled slave. So that struggle has been going on for generations. And America has always been two, not one. That's what John Edwards is talking about. Two Americas. One America is simply enough, the tradition of the Confederacy. The other is the tradition of the Union. Now, both of them are led by Watts, one Lincoln, and one's Jefferson Davis. Difference night and day. The progressive America is Lincoln, Roosevelt, Kennedy. The reactionary America is Jefferson Davis, Ronald Reagan, and Bush 1 and 2, especially 2. Anglo-Saxon, okay, Southern, in Bush's case sort of transferred from North to South, but Southern core, fundamentalist Protestant, and wealthy. Slave owners updated, and what you're looking at is something like a neo-Confederacy. That's what's going on. Now, my father, the son of a field slave, fought that America to the death from day one. And, well, I try to continue with that tradition. That is the enemy. Capital E. Either one America or the other will triumph in the end. That's what the Civil War is about, and it's still going on. This crisis is similar to the Civil War and other crises between the two Americas. And it's choose-up time. That's what is happening. Now, my father was point man for the progressive America. Anti-war, opposed three of them. Cold War, Korean War, Vietnam War. He's talking about, I'm looking for freedom, full freedom, now, not an inferior bread. Either or. There's no such thing as half free. And secondly, to add to culture and race, the issue of class. Yeah, I'm for the meek inherit the earth means they take it. And right now, class is big time, in case you hadn't noticed, although you can't say that, you say working families, but don't you dare say working class or you can't get elected dog catcher because you're some kind of socialist, communist, or whatever. However, this country is two Americas, 80% below $75,000 a year and 20% above $75,000 a year. Well, that's the issue. The country's now run for the top 20%, actually the top 10 or so, 15, blacks included, and other 80% later for them. Well, the 80% time has come, and that's a big issue among black folks. So you're talking about class, race, and culture all together. You can't leave any of them out. And the fourth leg of the chair is peace, because if you got some liberals running around, well, they're Cold War liberals, well, we'll do guns and butter. We got to fight either communism or terrorism or whatever abroad and establish some kind of empire. They're going to deep six everything progressive. No, you can't have progressive domestic policy and a warlike or imperial foreign policy and have a decent anything at home. And you don't believe it, look what Truman did with his, he started the Cold War, and Johnson, the war on poverty, turned out to be a kind of a half measure. Because black folks, minorities, poor folks were not in power. It was against that background that for centuries they've gone after the progressives. And by progressives, I mean, let's say Tom Paine, who said against slavery, et cetera, et cetera. Now, Jefferson's a slave owner, so that's a big difference. So read Tom Paine and then read the Declaration of Independence, and you'll see the difference. So my father, 40, 50 years ago, is way out on the progressive side, point man. So he was lucky to survive at all. Now, they began going after him under COINTELPRO, that's the FBI, under a progressive president, Roosevelt, who even with all his power couldn't get rid of Hoover. Hoover more or less did what he wanted, law or no law. So he started going after Dad when he was at the height of his popularity in the 1940s. Ballot for Americans, Bard of Liberty, Herald of Freedom, Othello, All-American, I mean, he was everything. They called him America's number one Negro, whatever that's worth. In any case, guest at the White House, all this. Hoover busy not only surveillance, but bugged his apartment, bugged his phone, on and on, followed him around, etc. This is 1940s. Come 1946, there's the Cold War, and Dad has nerve enough to go down to Washington, D.C., by the way, co-chairman of the campaign for crusade against lynching with Albert Einstein, no less. So they go down to ask Truman end lynching. Oh, no, Truman said, I can't do that because it's a political issue, the time isn't right, and so on. Well, Dad's saying it's a moral issue. And by the way, Mr. President, I must say, if the federal government can't protect black folks in the South, maybe veterans down there will have to defend themselves. Then you'll have to send federal troops there. So Truman jumps up, shakes his finger. That sounds like a threat. He's all red in the face. And Dad, all 6 feet three, 240 pounds, still athletic, slowly gets up from his seat. And the Secret Service men on either side of the president's desk, they jump out to the side of his desk, open up the jacket showing the 45. And they're just standing there. And somebody in the delegation other than Dad said, well, we meant no threat to the president. And Dad said, of course not. I meant no disrespect to the office of the presidency. I just was expressing how black folks, who are 10% of the population, feel. So Truman sputters, okay, this meeting's over. So this is headline. Robeson and Truman go at it. And from the Freedom of Information Act documents I got, is right after that meeting, President Truman calls in General Vaughn, who's his military aide, and says, this Robeson fella, he's getting to be kind of a problem. Why don't you tell J. Edgar Hoover to kind of keep tabs on it? Now that means Hoover has license to help the president solve his problem. And we know what that is. Well, by some coincidence, this is 46, right after that, that's called by the House Un-American Activities Committee. He tells them to go, well, I won't quote it, but he was a lawyer, so he wound them around his finger. But in the meantime, suddenly he's picketing. After a concert, he picketed a segregated movie theater in St. Louis, and on the way to another town with a friend of his, the left front wheel of the car comes off on the highway. Well, fortunately, they weren't going too fast, and nothing happened. But if you're going fast and the left wheel comes off, you swerve into the oncoming traffic. You're very dead. And that happens to be a signature of the FBI. Their hits are by retired FBI people who, some of whom, they have this way, you sabotage, oh, it's easy to sabotage the wheel. You loosen up the thing so that the wheel comes off when the speed comes up. And then in the 1950s, there were two more such incidents. Of course, that's no longer under Truman, that's under Eisenhower, who's a liberal Republican. Well, if you recall, he says, watch out for the military-industrial complex. He's talking about these people, whom he can't control. Okay, so flash forward to Kennedy. He's the first Irish Catholic ever to be president, and he's talking about, if you read his inaugural address carefully, he's talking about peace. Say the real enemy is disease, poverty, and war itself. So he's talking about ending the Cold War. And on top of that, he says there's a line in which he says a free nation that cannot protect its rich, that cannot help its poor, cannot save its rich. Well, that was his death warrant. I mean, especially Irish Catholic can't do that. Okay. So this is the people that did the following to my father. This MK Ultra now, because CoinsoPro didn't work. That was all kinds of psychological warfare and so on. That just didn't work. They tried to discredit him by spreading lies about him, etc., etc. So I don't go into the details of that. That's going to be in my second volume. But they decided they needed to do, let's say, a little more effective neutralization measures. So there's a program called MK Ultra, where the CIA developed under Helms and Alan Dulles a program for using a special drug, later known as LSD, hallucinogenic drug, which if you drop a little and give somebody a Mickey Finn with that, the reaction, chemical reaction is such that extreme depression, and people get so depressed and frightened and whatnot, they usually commit suicide. And then, of course, they have a depression, terrible, you know. Well, there was an incident in 1961. My father was abroad. He'd gotten his passport, couldn't travel to China and elsewhere, like Cuba and China and a couple of other countries. He had never been to Africa. He wanted to go there. So he, since he's under surveillance in London, decided, well, he'd been abroad 4 or 5 years. Time to go home, join the civil rights movement, so he's going to violate the passport regulations, go to Africa and then China. And on the way back, Fidel Castro had invited him to drop in at Havana, so he decided he'd do that. The problem was he couldn't do that from London too well, because not only the CIA and military intelligence, but London's the British MI6 is something like these American people. That's under Tony Blair these days. He's brought them back big time, even though he's a Labour person. But in any case, Dad wisely says, well, I'll go to Moscow and take off from there. Problem was that it was a few weeks before the Bay of Pigs. So,
welcome back. And that was a lecture by Paul Robeson Jr. Talking about the state of repression in the United States. That's going to end our program for today. You've been listening to the Pan-African Journal, worldwide radio broadcast for Sunday, April 9th, 2023. If you'd like to have access to this program, just go to the Pan-African Radio Network, and that's at blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. If you'd like to read the Pan-African Newswire, just go to our website at panafricannews.blogspot.com. That's panafricannews.blogspot.com. We'll close out with the music of Booker Little from the album entitled Out Front. This is Abayomi Azikiwe signing off, and have a beautiful week.